In 2009, the film director Pete Docter had an idea for a kids' movie about a girl who was grappling with complicated emotions. Docter is the guy behind a whole string of animated hits for Pixar, but this time he wanted to make a film in which the main characters didn't just have emotions, they were emotions. The issue was, which ones?
Yeah, so he needed to pick one or two emotions as his central characters so that there would be a protagonist.
Writer Susan Cain has the story.
He spent some years with Fear and Joy as the two central protagonists.
All right, what are we watching?
Fear, I don't think you can handle this. It's a scary movie.
And then he realized that the movie wasn't working.
Thank you, Joy, but I'll have you know I'm not scared of everything.
He was years into the production and he felt like the whole thing was a big failure. And he started to feel as if those hits that he had enjoyed were all a big fluke. And his mind kind of went spiraling out and he started feeling that he was going to lose the whole thing. His beloved career of his and also his beloved colleagues, everything that he knew and loved, he was going to lose. With that apprehension came this realization. He started feeling really sad, and he realized that this sadness was the great bonding agent, because it was his sadness that was making him aware of how connected he was to all these fellow filmmakers who he loved so much.
I'm sorry they took your rocket. They took something that you loved. It's gone forever.
Sadness was the key, and sadness was the character that had to be the protagonist of this movie.
Sadness. Don't make him feel worse.
Sorry.
And so he went back to the executive board of Pixar and said, we have to redo the whole thing with sadness at the center. And he was really nervous about how they were going to take that, because they live in the same culture that you and I do, which doesn't really like sadness very much. But he somehow convinced them and it became a gigantic hit.
I bet you and Riley had great adventures.
Oh, they were wonderful.
What art often does for us is speak the truths that we don't say in everyday life.
The giant hit was, of course, the film Inside Out, which came out in 2015 and went on to win an Oscar. Writer Susan Cain has a talent for uncovering deep emotions and undervalued personality traits. Her best-selling book, Quiet, made the case for the power of introverts in an always-on, always-out-loud culture. Now she has a new, equally restorative book out, this one championing an emotion almost nobody wants to feel. Sadness. The book is called Bittersweet. Cain told Steve Paulson, it's one of those words we use without really thinking about what it means.
Yeah, and I do think we tend to use it to describe a particular moment in time, which it does, but to me it also describes a kind of state of being or a state that we can be prone to. And the state is a kind of intense awareness that in this life, joy and sorrow and light and dark are always paired. And in fact, there's a wonderful Arabic proverb that goes, days of honey, days of onion.
Hmm.
And it's also an intense awareness of impermanence and of the fact that everyone and everything that we love will not live forever. And the amazing thing that comes with this awareness, which is an intense sense of beauty, of the beauty of the world and the joy of the world, that almost mysteriously comes with this apprehension of its bittersweetness.
Hmm. Are you saying that if you just have the sweet, just have the joy, it's maybe a little empty without the underlying sadness?
I don't even know if I would say it's empty. And, you know, I love to have joy just as much as anybody else does. I would say more that it's not true, that to pretend that that's all that life is not true. And therefore to live that way is shutting ourselves off from that truth and from all that's to be gained by looking in a clear-eyed way at what life does hold for us.
Well, there's a phrase that philosophers use. They talk about the paradox of tragedy. We often gravitate towards things that do make us sad, like movies or songs, even though I think most of us would say the last thing in the world we want is to be sad. We don't want that in our lives. How do you explain this?
I explain it in this way. When you look at the kind of art that people tune into that's sad, you know, whether it's sad songs or sad movies or Greek tragedy or whatever it is, what you realize is that these things that we're tuning into are not only sad and they're beautiful. They're the two combined. Researchers have actually looked at what happens when, let's say, we look at a series of pictures of sad faces, just pure sad faces. We don't actually love that. So it's the sadness and the beauty together that we love, you know, the romantic spires poking through the clouds. That's what we love.
Why don't we just want the beauty in itself? I mean, why does the sadness have to come with it?
The reason is that we are all of us creatures who are born into this world with a kind of fundamental longing for a more perfect and beautiful world. And we know this because every one of our religions has told us this story. We're longing for the Garden of Eden. We're longing for Mecca. We're longing for Zion. The Sufis call it the longing for the beloved of the soul. And then we see it in our art. You see Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz is longing for somewhere over the rainbow. Or Harry Potter enters the story at the exact moment that he's just become an orphan and he's going to spend the rest of his life longing for these parents who he can't remember. That's fundamental to the human condition. And that sense of longing is also one of our greatest strengths and powers. It is our creative source. It's also our spiritual source. Our religions tell us this. So whether we're atheists or believers, it doesn't make a difference. This is still fundamental to our DNA.
And what you're saying just seems so right, so true to me. And yet, we live in a culture, we in America, in a culture that is obsessed with positivity. You call it the culture of positivity. We're expected to put a good face on a bad situation. That's a problem, isn't it?
It is a problem. It leaves us especially ill-equipped when difficult moments do happen, like the one that we've been in these last couple, you could say the last couple of years with the pandemic, or you could say more broadly than that with the broader social fraying that we're having. The problem with only being positive is that, yeah, that we're not telling the truth and that we're not tuning into some of the deeper states that we have and to our ability to connect with each other, which depends to some degree on being able to respond to each other's sufferings, which is what humans are designed to do. That's not just a Sunday school teaching. You know, we're evolutionarily designed to react when we see another being in distress. So to only tune to the positive, it's, you could call it a spiritual impoverishment.
What would our culture look like if we were not always putting a good face on everything? You know, if we showed that life really is hard, if that was just out there for pretty much everyone to see?
Well, I think it would look more interesting for one thing. It would just be more interesting. You know, people would talk to each other in a more real way. I also hold out the hope that to do this could repair some of the fraying social bonds that we're experiencing. We have in our bodies, it's called the vagus nerve. It's the biggest bundle of nerves we have, and it's so fundamental. It regulates our breathing and our digestion, and it's a very ancient part of the human body. And our vagus nerve also reacts when we see another being in distress. So we're designed to do this, right? If we could figure out a way for people on opposing sides of political divides or class divides or whatever we want to look at just for people to be telling each other their stories, absent any discussion of politics or policy or anything like that, just to be talking about who they truly are. I think that could move us along towards seeing each other as humans again.
I want to bring COVID more directly into this. How has the pandemic changed how you think about this whole subject of the bittersweet? Has it complicated things for you?
No. For me, it's actually simplified things. How do I say it? I've been working on this book for years now, so long before the pandemic. I've been wondering this question about sweet music about sad music. That was a funny Freudian slip. about sad music for decades. So to me, before the pandemic, it had always seemed like, it had always seemed this strange thing to me that if times were good, that was all anybody thought was real. And then when times are bad, that's all anyone thinks is real. So to me, the pandemic is more like, okay, now there's a bit of an opening up to talk about all the sides of human experience.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it didn't surprise me in the same way.
But you've also been really hit personally by it. I mean, your brother died of complications from COVID, right?
Yeah. My brother and my father, both of them.
Wow.
Yeah. For my brother, it was right at the beginning. He was a doctor at a hospital in New York City. So it was very early on in the pandemic. And then my father about a year later. So the pandemic has definitely, I don't know how to explain it. I mean, it's been full of grief, but not surprise, I guess is what I would say.
Yeah. It does make me wonder if the wound is just sometimes too deep to heal.
There are some wounds. I think there are some wounds that are too deep. I think both things are true. I think many wounds heal much more than we think they would ever be capable of. And there are some wounds that are too deep to heal. I think both of those things are true.
So you sort of touched on this, but I want to go a little bit further here. Do you have thoughts on how we as a society collectively can become whole again after so much grief and trauma? I mean, most obviously because of COVID, but because of all the other stuff that's happening in our culture these days.
I think we have to do two opposing things simultaneously. And one of those things, as I say, is to make way more space than we do to be able to tell each other what we're actually feeling. Like in our workplaces, there's so much of feeling. I go in and I talk to a lot of workplaces, especially about harnessing the power of introverts at work. And so like I see what happens. I'll come into a Zoom meeting, let's say, and somebody asks the question of like at the beginning before we get started, someone will ask, how's everybody doing today? Everybody types into the chat box about how they're doing so great and they're so thrilled and they're so pumped and they're so grateful. And, you know, it's great if they're all feeling those things, but I often wonder what are the chances that everyone truly is feeling what they're purporting to. So making a lot more space than we do on the one hand would be incredibly useful. And then on the other hand, I think we need more gateways for tuning in, not just to like a superficial poppy happiness, but into deeper states of beauty and joy, really actively working those into our days, to begin our days by tuning into beauty. I mean, that's something people could do in their workplaces too, like share with each other sort of daily shots of beauty. I think we need more space for that as well.
How do you try to do that in your own life?
Well, I actually started this during the pandemic. I started actively following a lot of art accounts on Twitter. So my feed now is full of art. And especially while I was writing the book, I every morning would begin the workday by choosing a favorite piece of art and then sharing it on my social channels. And I would usually pair it with a favorite poem or quotation or idea or something like that that went along with the art and share it out. And it often took quite a while to assemble it, but it was such a both a grounding and uplifting way to start my workday. And what it really did is connected me with this whole community of people who are oriented in that direction too. And that's been just an incredible gift.
Can I just say, I love that idea. I do not do it myself, and I think I'm going to start, but I love the idea of just, that's the first thing you do when you wake up is somehow seek out beauty.
Oh my gosh, you have to let me know, because I really did find it transformative when I started doing this.
Susan Cain is the best-selling author of Quiet. Her new book is called Bittersweet: How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole. She was talking with Steve Paulson, and because this is audio, we had to end with one last question. How does bittersweet sound?
I have one sad musician who is Leonard Cohen, who I just love beyond all reason. And in fact, I dedicated my whole book, Bittersweet, to him. And the epigraph to the book comes from his song, Anthem, a particular line from that song, which goes,
"Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. Gets in.
There is a crack That's in everything. That's how the light gets in.
That's how the light gets in.
And that's my entire philosophy, and the fact that he put it so beautifully and pithily in one line and in an entire body of work is why I love him so much.
It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX.